Hi, my name's Evie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know if I want to puke or have diarrhea. I thought I'd get that off. You know, they say if you say it, it will lose its power. So I hope something leaves. I know that God is present, because about this time my ass goes into convulsions. And that's just before God kicks in. I had the opportunity to just have dinner. My sponsor is speaking in the main room. She referred to me at dinner as the lounge act. She told me that all I have to do is get dressed and God will do the rest, and I've taught you how to dress. Now go be yourself. What I'd like to do is I would I didn't have an opportunity to see everybody who's new in the first 30 days. Would you really mind, because I would like for you to stand up so I can really see who you are. If you've got 30 days, in your first 30 days. Okay. I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's my opinion that you're the lifeblood of the program. And I know that it takes a lot of courage, not only to step into being sober, but it also takes a lot of courage to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at a conference this size. So I want to acknowledge you for your courage, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Now, before I forget, I'd like to thank the committee. This is for Mary Sainer. No, really, it is. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me. It really is a privilege. It really is a privilege to be here. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. And the listening that you're going to provide for me is that I absolutely know in my heart that you really want me to win, and you don't want me to be a mess up here. And that you're here to support me. You know, it's like I go to do this, and it's like everything in me, I'm sitting over there thinking there's been a mistake. There's absolutely been a mistake, because I can't remember anything. And they went, you know, like if you're new and you're wondering what this is all about, it's about fear. And, you know, the definition of fear is false evidence appearing real. And at this point, it doesn't seem false. It seems very real. But what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is we just keep showing up. And there's a tremendous things that happen here. And, you know, I had the a guy by the... I want to tell a little story. There's a man here who I met a few years ago, actually, Don. I met Don and in San Francisco years ago. And I guess he submitted a tape of mine years ago, And I didn't know anything about that. This is what I was told. They called me last year and they said, we'd like for you to come and chair in L.A. And I said, gosh, you know, I'd really like to, but I'm already going somewhere else. And he said, Lou said, well, we've been waiting for you to turn 10 years sober. And I said, well, you didn't let me know that. So I'm speaking in Dallas. And he said, well, is that really confirmed? And I said, well, they are a little different there in L.A., right? Like, L.A. has now asked you, you now come. And I said, well, darling, Dallas didn't care whether or not I was 10 years sober, so I told them that I would go there, and I am a woman of my word, so I'm really sorry, but thanks for the invitation. So they got me back this year, and it's really, I want you to know that it is an honor and a privilege to be here with you. Now what are you all laughing about? That is straight up the truth. I'm gonna tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. So that's a little bit of really what it's about, is it's the past, the present, and the future. And I hope to God that God has something interesting. You know what I do? As I get in front of the toilet, I just got in front of the toilet. See, my hand's still shaking. I get down in front of the toilet, and I get on my knees, and I ask God to allow me to be a channel. And if you knew, the reason I get down in front of the toilet is that's where I did all of my most sincere praying before I got here. You know, you're just right there about old American Standard. Oh, God, I swear to God. If you just get me through this one, I promise I'll never do it again. And then, you know, then we get here, and the first problem we have is turning our whole life over to the care of God. It's kind of, you really see that, you know, it's kind of ironic. We surrendered in front of that toilet, I don't know how many times. But we get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and when you surrender my life to God, I just don't think that that's a possibility. You see, I don't trust God. But at any rate, to give you a little background, you know, you all get really quiet. To give you a little background of where I came from, I was born in San Jose, California, to Henrietta and Jim Cartwright. I don't know why I have another day that I have a boy. It's going to be interesting. I was born in 1955. That makes me 39 years old. And if I forget to tell you, I got sober the last time I did anything. That means the last time I put anything up my ass, in my ear, or down my throat was July the 11th, 1983. In case I forget to tell you. And that is a miracle. I grew up with the kind of people they refer to in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, seeking lower companionship. I didn't grow up with those kind of people that were, like, kind of, you know, like, maybe in a Buick Skylark and then progressed down. You know, we were just always in an old beat-up Ford behind some old sleazy-ass beat-up bar. And I love country western music my whole life because I grew up listening to Merle Haggard. I'm always on a mountain when I fall. Yeah, so it's like, and today I love country. Actually, I have a belt with my name on the back of it. I've had it for years. I was country before country was cool. That is absolutely the truth. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had this kind of an attitude. I wore flannel shirts, Wrangler jeans, cowboy boots, 2 6-packs of beer, and fuck you. And if you're new, through good sponsorship, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and working the steps, I've actually learned to tap into my feminine energy. I had my first drink in an old beat-up Ford in a little town right out of Hollister, California, and I think that you learn how to mimic the people that you grow up with. I didn't grow up with the kind of people that took a glass and put ice in it and then took the liquor and poured it into a glass and had a cocktail. The kind of people I grew up with pulled it out from underneath the seat, and they cranked off the lid and they took a big swig. And whoever else was in the car, they'd all take a big swig, and you know how they do that? They crank that lid off, and they'd kick it back, and they'd take a big old swig of that and go. And you know, I don't know, I saw that I don't know how many times, and to give you a little bit of kind of like the family background, I lost my real mother when I was very young, and I grew up with a cousin. And my cousin was a little bit of a loose woman, actually. She fancied herself a professional prostitute. She just got charged most of the time. The way it worked out is this way. If she'd been bedding down with him a week, they were Uncle Charlie. And if she'd been fucking him a month, they were Daddy. So a little bit of the family background there. And I can tell by the way you're relating that some of you can, you know, you've kind of been there. But at any rate, it was one of those evenings where they said, you know, this is what they always say, they're going to have a quick one. You know, they go into the bar, they say, we're going to have a quick one, we'll be right back. About 5 hours later, they show up with a bag of peanuts and a Coke, and they refer to that as dinner. That's why I don't have a lot of my teeth today. Wow, I don't even get into that. You can't see that. It's pretty good, actually. Oh, shit, I have no idea what, you know, you just go into this. It's unbelievable. I have no idea what I'm going to tell you, but it's going to be real. But then again, I am the lounge act. But what happened this night is after you've been in a car for 4 or 5 hours, you know, the authorities get a little concerned, so what they have you do is they have you lay down in the car. And I don't know why it was any different that night, but I felt underneath the seat, and I pulled out a bottle of Seagram 7. You know, those flat bottles, you know, and it had like this much in it. And I cranked off the lid of that bottle, and I kicked it back, and I took my first drink of whiskey. And I kicked it back just like they did. You know, I cranked that lid, and I kicked it back, and it come out of my ears, and my, it come out of my nose, and just like... sucked the wind right out of me, you know. And I'm thinking, my God, no wonder they grunt when they drink this, you know. But I think if you're an alcoholic, now really, if you're an alcoholic of my type and kind, something happened. And I want you to know that I felt that booze go all the way down. I felt it burn all the way down. And when it got to my belly, it kind of spread out and went, whoa. And that's the magic. See, the magic that happened, you know, right in that moment. For the first time in my life, I was about 10 years old, and for the first time in my life, I had a sense of relief. A sense of relief. Because that's what alcohol provided me. It provided me for a way not to feel anything. You know, you hear a lot of people talk, I heard a lot of people talk about when they drank alcohol, who they became. You know, there's a guy up Calistoga. His name was Duffy. He just recently passed away, and I remember him saying that when he drank alcohol, you know, he didn't know about anybody else, but when he looked behind, now he's about 6'3", 300 pounds, and bald, and he said, you know, when I drink two shots of whiskey, I started to get a full head of hair. And after I had about six shots of whiskey, I became the best-looking son of a bitch in the bar. You know, alcohol did a lot for us. It didn't turn me into somebody, but it made me not have to feel. And that was what I didn't want to do. I just didn't want to feel. You know, when I was really little, I just didn't quite understand, you know, growing up. It was like I had a lot of pain. You know, I had a lot of pain. You know, my mother, you know, it's always an honor and it's always a privilege to be here, and my mother is Indian and Mexican, and in the Valdez family, myself and my little brother are sober today. I want to tell you something about my little brother. I promised him that when I would chair in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would say hello to you. My brother took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1979 or 80. And my brother didn't make the choices to stay sober. And today, my little brother's doing 30 years in Deer Lodge, Montana, and he doesn't have a choice today. And that's where this disease can take you. It can take you to places like that. So what I want you to know is that if you're new tonight, and even if you're not so new tonight, that you don't ever have to drink or use again, that you can make the choice to stand in being sober. It's not easy being sober. And like I said, you know, I was up in the hills talking to a bunch of sober bikers up in the Northern California. I looked out into the, all I could see was leather and tattoos. And I don't know where it came. You know, God channels different things through you at different times. And I'm going to say it, and I hope nobody gets offended, and I know it's not a politically correct thing, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyhow. As I looked out into this bay of all, there's all these Harleys parked on the hill, and I looked out and said that it takes a lot of courage because any pussy can drink. And I don't know why I said that to those people, but you know what? It really spoke to their listening. Because you never know why you're going to say things. And I didn't know I was going to say that. But there were some of those big bikers that came up to me and they said, you know, you've probably ruined my drinking for the rest of my life. So I hope that I didn't offend any of you, but I just want you to know that it takes an awful lot of courage to stay here. Tana, and he doesn't have a choice today. And that's where this disease can take you. It can take you to places like that. So what I want you to know is that if you're new tonight, and even if you're not, they put me over here. I grew up the majority of my childhood. I spent in San Francisco and Oakland, in that area. The woman that I live with preferred sailors, so we lived in that area. And a lot of ships over there, a lot of ships. Let's talk about Oh, chips. Well, there's chips. You know, when I'm a retread in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one of those people that they didn't think was ever going to make it. And for a long time, I didn't think I was going to make it. I just didn't think I was going to make it. Because it was just too tough for me. I used to sit in the back of the room because I had such an inability to trust anybody that I couldn't allow anybody to get close to me. You know, when I was growing up, you know, I grew up in the streets of Oakland and San Francisco, and what I learned how to do is I learned how to survive. You know, I sold Haight-Ashbury News, I got it, you need it, you buy it, you read it, only a dime. It was the best scam I ever had. And, you know, it was some hippie made this paper and I had to sell it for 10 cents, and all the people from Minnesota and Wisconsin were always driving through Haight-Ashbury to, like, look at the freaks, you know, all these people. And I would, like, walk down the middle of the cars, and I only had to get a dime for it, and I'd, you know, just tell all these stories, and they were actually true stories, and they would give me lots of money. And then I used to go down into to Golden Gate Park, and all those people that moved from Minnesota and they were looking for free love and had no idea how to live. I'd buy day-old donuts and feed them. I have absolutely no idea why I'm telling you that. Because I did that, that's why. Yeah. We're going to have some fun tonight, so sooner or later I'm going to get sober. I haven't even got drunk yet. Actually, it's a joke. This is an ACA talk. I'm like the KGB. They slipped me in. They thought I was going to give an AA talk. You're wrong. It's an ACA talk. But I did drink somewhere along the line. I swear to God, I drank. I spent the majority of my childhood growing up with people and taking care of them. You know, I was in treatment. One of the times I went through treatment, I was telling this man, "You just don't understand. I'm not really an alcoholic. I'm a dope fiend. I'd be anything. You know, I'm a cocaine addict. I'm not an alcoholic. And it's really obvious to me that I'm not where drug addicts should be, because all these people are like a bunch of goddamn winos." And he said, you know, and it's like, oh my God, the arrogance. You know, but the bottom line is in that moment is that in my mind, I had a picture of what a woman alcoholic looked like. And the first 10 years of my childhood, I spent, from the time I was 3 years old until I was 13, I spent growing up with a woman that would do anything for a drink. And I seen a lot of things, and I went to a lot of places that little kids should not go. And towards the end of her drinking, before we were taken from her, we were in Watsonville. Living in Watsonville, by now she's doing the labor camps. You know, and we were living in Watsonville we had a box springs on the floor and we had artichoke crates. And in the morning, she'd get up and she'd drink off a bottle of Carlo Rossi Red Mountain wine and she'd puke all over herself. And I'd clean her up. And pretty soon she could drink enough and she could keep it down. And I'd clean her up. So in my mind, I always knew what a woman alcoholic looked like. And I want you to know that I never looked like that. So how could I possibly be an alcoholic? You know, I thought that that's where you had to go in order to be here. So I want you to know that if you're new, you don't have to go to those places and you don't have to do the things that I did in order to get here. You know, one of my last, I was in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they used to, you know, they got to the point where they didn't say to me, but I shouldn't wear no makeup. They used to say to me, they never bothered with that 90 meetings in 90 days. They just looked at me and said, "Edie, we think you ought to go to treatment." Straight up, straight trip, right to treatment. No, we'll just take you there. You know, I don't know about any of you that are new, but when I was new, thank you very much. I never asked questions because I suffered from being terminally cool. I was actually too cool for the freezer. I sit in the back with, you know, in my little get-up with my sunglasses on, just waiting for it to get over. judging and assessing all of them. And by the time the meeting was over, I knew I wasn't one of them. One more time, thank you very much. I'll leave now. They used to, you know, in the meetings, they talk about, the old timers talk about yet. You know, those yets, you haven't had any of those yet. Like, to this day, I have never gotten a drunk driving yet. That doesn't mean that that isn't a possibility, but the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, that won't, I really hope that won't be necessary. And I believe that it won't. But they always tell those horror stories. You know, back in the early 70s, late 70s, early 80s, they tell all these horrible stories. And then say, well, if you want to go and drink, you can have that too. What happened, I go in and out of the meetings and in and out of the meetings, and some of these yet started showing up in my life. But I'm a blackout puking drinker. And you know how my drinking progressed, and what happened is I quit drinking hard liquor because it must be the Indian in me. And then I progressed to wine, and I kept having blackouts and doing stupid things. So I thought, well, if I drink only Coors Light beer in the silver can, because that's not even really beer. in my trying to do it my way, I got off work one evening and went down to a little sleazy bar in Winton, California, called the Wagon Wheel. Yeah, the Wagon Wheel is one of those bars that you kind of smell two blocks away, you know. The kind that have pig's feet in the back, you know. And I started to drink my Coors. I was just going to have a couple of Coors Lights. And I don't know what happened, but I went away. Do you ever go away? You just kind of go away. You just kind of leave. And when I came back, I was in my car with sort of a heavy man. Not only was he heavy, he was hairy, and he had a lot of tattoos. He had on a Levi jacket with the sleeves were cut off, kind of, and he had a red bandana. And I could, growing up in the area where I grew up, in the environment I grew up, you can always tell quality tattoos from county jail tattoos, from state and penitentiary. You know, I know a good penitentiary tattoo, and I know a good county jail tattoo. And I looked at him, and he'd spent a lot of time in the county jail. You look over and you just wonder, huh? It's just one of those, huh? And I don't know about any of you, but when I got really drunk, it didn't matter. You sort of kind of get a sense of your body. Start feeling your body, wondering where I've been with him. I know, it's sad, it is, it's sad. And there was movement. There was some movement occurring in my car. And I turned around, in the back seat was a woman in a pink boob tube with Hell's Angels wings tattooed permanently to her chest. And I said, huh. Yeah. This is where that, in that moment, I was absolutely clear. It was like clear as a bell. That these people could be yes. Yes, they could be yes. But what do you what do you actually do in a moment like that? You don't turn to these people and say, look, I've just come out of about a 4-hour blackout. I'm in the chronic stages of alcoholism. To stay sober. I go to those AA meetings and they tell me that you people are yes. And I really need to cut this shit out. And so will you take me home? Now, straight up, you all know mind says, this is an alcoholic mind in its peak performance. It says, you should probably find out their names. Maybe possibly where you met them. And then, this is it, Edie. Why don't you just tie on a really good one? You know, let's just tie on a really good one and get done with this. We need to get complete with this drinking shit. Because these things that they call yes are really occurring in your life more rapidly and more frequently than you had anticipated. Could be that you are in a bad situation. You know, I turned to this guy and I said, so, you got any beer? Let's just kind of break the ice a little. And he said, yeah, you bought beer in Sacramento. That's about 2 hours from the wagon wheel. And then I said, so where are we going? You know, he just, you know, but you know, when you're with people like that, they're a lot like you, they just kind of look and blink and then, oh, okay, well, we're going to Reno. Gonna go up there and buy some drugs with your money that you got out of the bank. Still had money in the bank, still had medical insurance, still had a few things. So about 4 days later, I decided I should do something. I woke up. You ever wake up at somebody's house and everybody's gone like they've gone to work? You ever do that? Just kind of wake up, wonder where everybody is. It's not my house. You go in the kitchen, you kind of look around. They have nice appliances. Must be pretty nice people here. You know, they have a trash liner in the garbage can. Oh, we must be an upper middle class family. About this time is when you refer to the number in your top part of your Wrangler jean. That's where I carry it. It's the most peculiar thing that, you know, I always made sure I had numbers from people in Alcoholics Anonymous on my body somewhere. And I called this woman, and her name is Mary D. in Turlock. And I said, Mary, I know you probably don't remember me, but you gave me your AA number, and your AA number. That's what I said to you, your AA number. Got that AA hotline. And I'm ready to go to that AA treatment place if you just come and get me. And she goes, oh, yes, I remember you. I remember you. And I said, well, I'm ready to go to treatment. I've been kind of on a little wing-ding here, and I'm experiencing those yets and stuff, you know. And she said, so where are you? I said, hold on. And I found a TV guide. I said, I hope this is correct. And I don't, you know, there's a lot of that day I don't remember. And she did come and pick me up, and I just love this. She did come and pick me up, and she did take me, and she deposited me in a place in Modesto, California, in the Scenic General Hospital called Reality. It's called Reality. It's really called Reality. It's still there. It's still open. And that's where she left me, in Reality. Now, I don't remember checking into Reality, but I do remember waking up. And I was not in good shape. I really want you to know, it's not pretty where I had taken myself. And when I did wake up, I was sitting on an old couch. One of those old couches, you know, where the springs are all wore out and somebody has to actually pull you kind of up out of that. I had on these green county pajamas, and they were stamped, little, you know, the green ones that tie in the front, and, you know, pretty basic, with Stanislaus County stamped all over it in case anybody wanted to take them. I had on a green striped robe where somebody had burnt cigarette holes all in it. And I was sitting on a couch with an old wino who was trying to roll a cigarette and spitting on the paper too much. I'll never forget this day. I looked around, I looked at him, and I said, so where are we? Where, just where in the hell have I got myself this time? And he looked at me and he said, "You're in detox." Detox. He didn't have any teeth, and he kept spitting on that old... And I said, "Oh, my God. Oh, my God." And, you know, it looked very serious. So, you know, if you're a good alcoholic, especially a grandiose alcoholic, you know, I looked around there. I looked at the attire I was wearing. And I still had Blue Shield insurance through the Carpenters Union. Obviously, I can get better facilities than they're providing me here. Any of you thought about that? I'm going to tell you about my last drunk in a minute. Yeah, in a few minutes, I'll tell you about that. If you're new, I want you to remember that part. I had medical insurance, and there had been a mistake. So what we do is we stand up, we try to, you know, we're going to pull this shit together. You know, we're going to pull that robe up, we're going to go talk to somebody. We need to inform the management here that there's no... And I want you to know that in the middle of this facility was this little sort of glass enclosed thing to get an idea of the type of facility I was in. They had to buzz you in. So I went over and I knocked on the door and there was a man in there and he buzzed me in. And I went in and I started to tell this man, you know, my tale of woe. You know, like, you know, there's been a mistake. There's really been a mistake. I want you to know, you know, I work for San Jose Steel and I have a job. My car's registered. Don't know where it is. I didn't tell him that. And I said, you know, this facility looks like it's more, you know, geared towards alcoholics, and I'm a cocaine addict. And he just nodded. And he listened, and the more he nodded, the faster I'd talk. You know, I just talk a little faster. You know, I want you to know that this man was a black man. And this African-American man, I want you to know, he saved my life. He saved my life. He looked at me and he said, "You know, honey, you got so much hurt inside of you that I don't know if there's any of us that will ever be able to reach you." He said, "But you came to us in really, really bad shape. And I can give you your clothes. And I can let you go back out there in it." He says, "But I don't think you have long with us, if that's what you choose to do." And he said, "I want you to know, Edie, that the very, very best that you could whip up out in that big, bad world got you right here. Yeah, honey, the best you could do got you here with us. And you don't even know that God has blessed you to bring you here." And in that moment, I heard something. You know, it's like for one instance, there was like an opening of my mind. And there was I let myself down a little bit. And I absolutely knew that he was telling me the truth. He was telling me the truth. And so what I did is I said, I don't think I really said anything. And I just got up and I walked out and I went and got a towel. And for the first time in my life, I went and got on in the women's shower area, and I closed the little shower curtain, and I got down on my knees, and I just begged God to help me. I said, "God, just help me, because I know that I'm in trouble. I know that I am in trouble." And what happened is they have, after you graduate and move out of detox, they have a 28-day program, and I went through the 28-day program, and after 48 days, they said, "Edie, you need to go now." You know. You really should leave. And I want you to know that I didn't want to go. That when I got there and I surrendered, it was like, just let me do the floors. It was that the thought of going out into the world and having to work and having to, like, do it and all of that. Because, you know, what I've learned since I've been sober, a lot of who I've been and my identity has been my job and all of that is who I am. And, you know, I got out of high school and I joined the Carpenters Union because I couldn't spell and I couldn't type and I couldn't read that well. And I worked good with my hands, so I joined the Carpenters Union. And, you know, at best, it's a tough life. It was a tough life. And it was like I didn't know how not to use and be in that profession. And anyhow, I checked out and You know, I couldn't stay sober, and so there was a place called First Street Fellowship. And First Street Fellowship is on the bad side of town, because that's where I felt comfortable, because that's where I came from. You know, I felt comfortable there. And it was an old metal building. It was probably about half as from there to that wall. I need to give you the dimensions being in construction. You know, I always think you want to know the width and the diameter. Like, you really don't give a shit how wide the room was, but I'm going to tell you. And there was an old man by the name of Earl that used to open up First Street Fellowship. And over in this corner of the building, they had all these old broken down chairs and couches and tables. And they played pinochle. They started at 6 o'clock in the morning and they went till midnight playing pinochle over in this corner. And then over here in this corner, they had a big area with tables, and that's where they had the AA meetings. And they had all these pillars between. It was just corrugated metal. It was like a sleazy little place, and I felt right at home. And I used to go there after work. I got a job on that first thing out of reality. About 3 weeks later, I got a job working for the city of Modesto. Check this shit out. I got a job right out of treatment working for the city of Modesto on training people re-entering society from prison about the basics of construction. Doesn't God have a sense of humor? So what I used to do is I used to get off work and I'd go down to First Street Fellowship and I would just hang out there. But I couldn't go to the AA meeting, and I'd just go sit in the couch, and I'd just sit there. I would just sit there. After work, I would just sit there. And after a while, old Earl said to me, there's an AA meeting over there in the corner. And I'd just sit and nod. And I'd just sit. And I don't know how long that old Earl and I did that dance of him telling me there was an AA. I kind of got mad at the old fart. So I thought, I can see there's an AA meeting over there in the corner. I don't need for you to inform me there's an AA meeting over there in the corner. I can see that for myself. Not that I had any anger when I got here. And one night he said to me, he said, if you're not going to go to the AA meeting, just like that, how about you go over there and wash some cups? And I thought, well, shit, I can wash cups. And you know what? Somebody had given First Street Fellowship, like, a whole bunch of those thick, you know, those mugs, that are, those real thick old China mugs that are, like, from the 30s, and I don't know where they're from, but they have those little pits in them, and they get kind of dirty. Well, God, I found myself, I went down to the grocery store and got me some Comet and some bleach. Yes, and I scrubbed those cups. I mean, I scrubbed those cups. All 200 of those cups, I scrubbed those cups. They were the shiniest cups you could ever see. And I mean, I got obsessed with cleaning cups. It's like, I got a job. I'm going to First Street Fellowship because I'm going to wash cups. You know, I didn't even know that was there, but I started taking so much pride. And what I started doing, well, first of all, I painted the kitchen because I was spending so much time in there. And then the second thing I did is I went down to the thrift store, got some curtains, you know, kind of cleaned the place up a little bit, you know. Went and got a couple of candles too, because, you know, all kinds of shit going in there. And then I started getting closer to those AA tables because, you know, if they quit drinking their coffee, I thought, well, they must be dead. Well, I'm going to get that cup. You know what? It wasn't very long before I was sitting at the table. It wasn't very long, and I want you to know that old Earl was my he was an angel in my life. You know, that old man, he died about a year ago. Old Earl died in First Street Fellowship, holding somebody with less than 28 days sober, and they were holding him when Earl passed on. And I want you to know that I think that Earl was the one that gave me my ticket to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, where I come from is I just didn't know how to just kind of walk in and plop down and say, where's the goddamn coffee? It's always been, you know, my life, I want you to know that part of one of those things is that the hardest thing I've learned to do in my sobriety is actually learn to accept love. actually accept love and let people contribute to me. That's probably been the hardest lesson that I've learned. I'm still learning in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, tonight, you know, in this front row is my sister, and my lover, and my best friend. And my sister, you know, 3 years ago, she gave birth to the two most beautiful baby girls, and I was in the room when she gave birth to them. And she blessed my life with Jordan and Taylor. And it totally shifted my life. You know that the healing that's gone on for me to be in those babies' lives is 3 years old. They just turned three last Monday. And they're so cute. They're so cute. You know, we're out in the park and the ice cream truck goes by and they just automatically start dancing. And we love them to death, you know. When I was 3 years old, I found my mom dead in the bedroom. My mom never made it to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. One day she just couldn't take the pain anymore, and she walked down the hall and she sat on the edge of the bed and she shot and killed herself. And I was the one that found her. And I was 3 years old. And they wonder why I didn't have anything to say for a long time. And I didn't really understand about life, you know, and I got thrown in living with Mary and not understanding. You know, a lot of my life has just been God. I just wish somebody would have put me up on their lap and told me that they loved me. That's really all I ever wanted. You know, one time I had a really bad habit. I'm just going to bawl my side. I must look like a goddamn mess up here. Well, that's okay. I got dressed in the beginning. Anyhow, I was living in the projects, and my God, it's only 9 o'clock. I got another 30 minutes. What in the hell am I going to tell you? Oh, I could talk about getting sober. I've been sober, though, huh? You know, that's just like those circuits. Can I have a little water, please? And you know those circuit speakers, you just know, I don't care how many times you hear me, you hear the same goddamn story every time. After a while, I get sick of that, so I've made a commitment that every time it's going to be new. Not only for me, but for you too. But anyhow, I'm living in low-income housing, there's not a lot of grass and stuff like that, and I had this bad habit of chewing gum off the ground. Now, we know why I did that, don't we? Because somebody told me not to. I don't know about any of you, but as soon as they told me, don't do that. Uh-oh. We just have to. So anyhow, I had a nickel, and there was this big old wad of Bozo, you know that Bozo gum that hadn't been chewed, it was still juicy and all. And boy, I was down there, I was working that gum, and here across the lot come this woman. Now when you grow up in an environment like that, by the time you're 5 or 6 years old, you know the probation officers from the social workers from, you just know. You just instinct. And here comes this woman. She was coming across the courtyard there, coming right at me, really intentional. And all her nylons are going. She got up to me and she looked down and she said, "My little girl, why don't you take that nickel and go buy yourself some gum?" I looked up at her and I said, "'Cause I want to chew this gum, that's why." If you're new, that deals right in the arena of surrender. But I had trouble surrendering. I really had a lot of problems surrendering. You know what happened to me is that woman went and she went and found who I lived with. She went and found Mary, and she came back down to the courtyard, and she had all my little belongings in a Safeway suitcase, and she said, they said you could go home with me. They said you could go home with me. Now, I remember riding across the Bay Bridge because I didn't have the value of a sack of potatoes. And pretty soon, Mary found out that if I wasn't living with her, she couldn't get any money. Essentially, she did this on, check this shit out. There was a guy on the USS Midway, and his name was Frank Roth. And he adopted me when I was little. That man adopted me. And when he went out to, the USS Midway goes out for like months at a time, and he went out and she took his, everything he had and sold it and left. And he had to pay child support on us for the rest. That's kind of a bad deal. But he found out that I wasn't living with her, and if I wasn't living there, she couldn't get any money from me. So she came back to this lady that I was living with. And you know that woman? You know that big woman who took me home? She, you know, she got me like, she bought me this little sailor suit, and I had like Flintstone sheets, and we had breakfast, and it was like I was in heaven. You know, I was really in heaven. And I remember the day that Mary was coming to pick me up, and that lady was crying. And I looked at her, and I said, don't let her see you cry. Don't let her see you cry. And I want you to know that's who came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Who I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous was a little half-breed that nobody ever wanted. And straight up, I was angry. I was full of hate, and I was full of pain. It was hard to reach me. And I didn't think that I was going to be able to make it. You know, I want you to know that I went to San Jose to a Unity Day, and Grady O'Hara was speaking. Yeah, Grady O'Hara was speaking. And she got up there, and I don't know exactly what she said, but she was the first woman that I'd ever heard say, fuck, with passion. And I thought, you know what, from where I've come from, I bet I could do my fourth step with her. You know, I didn't know that I was going to any length, but I moved from Modesto to Sacramento so Grady could sponsor me so that I could do my fourth step with Grady. That is absolutely the truth. I moved to Sacramento so Grady could sponsor me. And I want you to know that she's been a blessing in my life. That she took me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that I went with her. I'm so, so glad that God placed Grady in my life so that when I went to her with my first four step, which was only one paragraph on a legal pad, and when she greeted me at the door, she didn't say, oh, I'm sorry, you didn't do it as pre-outlined. I heard somebody in a meeting talk about turning somebody away. I heard somebody talk about turning somebody away because they didn't do it as, oh, who knows? It was wrong. God didn't put somebody in my life like that. You know what Grady did? He took me into her living room, and I sat there and I cried for 2 hours. For the first time in my life, I opened up to another human being. And I told her all those things. All those secrets and all those things I never thought I could tell another human being. And I want you to know that if you're new, there's freedom in that. There's freedom in that. Incredible freedom. You know, my first home group was primary purpose, and Grady was, she directed my life. She told me, next time you think you got an idea, drop by the, she owned a Swanson's Cleaners, and she goes, drop by the cleaners, because let me tell you straight up, anything you think's a good idea is a bad idea. For the first couple of years, I just did that. You know, I did that. And I want you to know that Grady has just moved to L.A. She's now here. She got here on Thursday. So if any of you are really looking for someone who knows how to guide and direct you in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, Grady's now a resident of your area. And she is the main attraction in the other room. I'm your lounge act. I don't care. It's just great to be here with you. So what happened is Grady started telling me what to do. At primary purpose, you showed up and you mopped the floors and you greeted people and you made coffee. And at the end of the meeting, you did a third step prayer in the bathroom whether you wanted to or not. And you showed up and you did a lot of service. You know, when I was 3 years sober, there was this guy that said to me, he said, E, why don't you get a job? Huh. I fancy myself self-employed. I was actually unemployable. But it sounded good. And he said that, you know, the state of California is hiring building inspectors. Why don't you go take a test? You know, and I thought to myself, I can't go do that. You know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the keys to the kingdom and that we can have anything we want if we're willing to do the work and show up. And, you know, some people in Alcoholics Anonymous, they helped me write you know, a resume and fill out the application, and the state of California allowed me to go take a test to become a building inspector for the state architect's office. And I showed up there and at the community center in Sacramento with 700 men. And one of the guys said to me, "Oh, coming down here to take the test for your daddy?" I said, "Yeah, he's home drunk. Somebody's got to." After a while, you sort of learn how to deal with that at some point. Well, we'll get into that a little bit later. But you know what happened to me? Is I got 85% on that test, and I was hired by the state to be a building inspector for the state architect's office. And, you know, I couldn't believe that. You know, from where I come from, I couldn't believe that. You know, I always had so much shame. You know, my family, even to this day, they're ashamed of the fact that they're Mexican and Indian. They're ashamed of the fact. And, you know, I want you to know today, I'm proud of that. I'm proud of that, and I'm proud of the fact that I'm gay. You know, I went down to the job in San Diego, and I was about three and a half, almost 4 years sober when I went to San Diego, and I was on the new prison down in Otay Mesa called Donovan Prison, and I was so proud, you know, that I got this job. You know, I was just so really proud, and I just thought I felt good, you know, like, oh my God, you know, maybe I can have a life too, you know, maybe I'm worth something, you know, maybe I can do something. And I had been on job sites for years, and I dealt with the discrimination and that, but I always work with my tools, and when you go to work with your tools, usually when they get that you're willing to work hard and do your job, they'll leave you alone. But see, now I'm in a new position. My position is actually of authority, deciding whether or not work gets done or if it gets approved. And, you know, I didn't really know what it was going to be like, and the first day, though, it was very clear to me. Very clear to me. They put me with an old guy by the name of Al. Al been in inspector for 28 years. Al wore a hard hat inside the car. You kind of get the drift about old Al. He's driving down there with his hard hat, and he kind of looks over at me and he says, "Yeah, knew them minorities were going to show up." Oh. You know, I look over and intuitively I think, not even banana nut bread's going to cure this guy. You bake that banana nut bread and somehow, you know, just feed him. So I thought, well, we'll make a little dull conversation with old Al here. And I said, well, what other minorities are coming besides me? Now, I don't want you to get offended, but I want you to get the clear about old Al. Al looked at me and says, "Yeah, we had two niggers, an Indian, and a cut. Now we're just waiting on the two niggers and the Indian." Now, if you knew. This is when you have two conversations occur. Straight up this side of the brain was like that little tough kid that grew up in the streets, and I could tell him a few things. But on this side of my mind is a woman who's clean and sober and has dignity and respect in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I made a choice. I looked at him and I said, "I realize that you must have resistance in my being here." "But it's not okay for you to ever, ever talk to me like that again." And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is a gift that I learned. You know, people like that, you know, he doesn't, you know, you have to have compassion. You know, the clear understanding of really unconditional love is having compassion for people when they're not in the place that you think they ought to be. We work on that on a daily basis. I want you to know the next day they had a little gift for me. Al had reported what he thought I was. So there's a little coffee can on my desk. I actually kept the paper to give to the attorney. I said, well, we should document this. There's a coffee can on the outside that says donations for penis transplant in Tijuana. And there was $6 in the can. I don't think you can get a penis in Tijuana for $6. I'm telling you this story because you know what? I didn't drink through any of that. No, I didn't drink through any of that. I lost about 16 pounds and after a year, but I want you to know what I did in San Diego. I went straight down and I got on H&I and I lived in the jails in San Diego. And I lived in Alcoholics Anonymous because that was the only place I knew where to go. And I kept showing up. And I used to go early and leave late and all that stuff. And after a while, it's something just this kind of a light come on and said, you know, maybe you should not be around this kind of continuous abuse. And I'd gone home to Sacramento and I'd applied for another job at UC Davis and they gave me an interview and I actually was off of that job a week before I got another job at Davis, you know. And you know, it's that thing, you look at your life and you just don't know what you're going to do, you know. And you're doing your best to stay sober and you're working the steps and you're working with others and then you have life hit you right in your face. Like, oh my God, what are we going to do now? You know, and I got this interview at UC Davis, and I went, and the day of the interview, they gave me the job description, which was like 6 pages. I read it. You should leave and go now. I said, just get in the car, leave. They'll never notice that you didn't stay. And you know, there's a woman down here that I used to listen to her tapes and for a long, long time. Her name was Sybil. Long time, so isn't her name Sybil? Sybil, yes. And see, I love a couple of the things she says. She says, I'll be honest with you as soon as I can get it past me. That's what she says. I said, I like that. And she says, sometimes the best we can do is just look up and wink at God and go give him the best sober person we are today. And I thought, you know, I'm already dressed. I might as well go for the job interview. I'll just do like Sable says. I'll just look up and wink at God and go give him the best sober person I am today. You know, I went to that job interview, and I'd never been interviewed by that many people. And I just gave him the best sober person I was. You know what? I knew at the end of that interview they were going to give me that job. And they did. They called me when I was 5 years sober, 2 days after I was 5 years sober, and they gave me that job. And I want you to know that I sued the state of California, and I won. And I learned how to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we just don't lay down. You know, it was like I went on to the university and I was, you know, I went and when you work for the UC system, I'm sure there's a few of you work for UC somebody. And they take you in and they show you this tape about who you've now just become employed with. And I bought it hook, line, and sinker. Oh, my God, have I arrived. What a wonderful place to be, a research facility and all. Oh, my God, you know that kid scraping that gum off the ground. My God. Oh, you know, you just, oh, my God. And I wasn't there 6 months and the administrator wanted to go and show me the job. He used to go to lunch at 11 and he returned at 3 and he was usually a little intoxicated. He had a little bit of a reputation. But I thought, well, you know, it's okay. He never said anything to me in the whole time I'd been there. And so we were walking out into the parking lot and I thought we would take one of the government vehicles and he said, no, we'll go in my car. Well, what are you going to say? No, I don't want to go in your car. So he loaded me up in his little Porsche. Took me out to the edge of the campus where it meets the freeway and said, you know, tell me about this sign. And, you know, straight up, it wasn't about that sign, was it? No. Hell no. Gets me back in the Porsche, and I think we're going to turn around and go back to work. No, he decides he wants to take me on Highway 113 and teach me how or show me how his Porsche tacks out. Like, I give a rat's ass about his Porsche tacking out. It wasn't too long that he had his little, he just reached over and he put his hand on my leg. Said he'd like to take me down to Bumps. Teach me his management style. If you knew. You say to Mr. Such and Such, my calendar is open. And anytime you want to speak to me during working hours, That'll really work for me. I don't get alcohol and I don't socialize with people outside of work because it just doesn't work for me. I want you to know that 3 weeks later, when I exited the building and I was walking, they stand outside and smoke. He looked at another one of these very powerful men and said, "Well, there goes our wasted piece of ass." Uh-oh. What step do you work on that? I think it's time to dress up in battle fatigue and just shoot them like they do in the mail rooms or whatever. Hopefully. But you know what? He didn't get any better. And pretty soon I was referred to as a militant, ball-burning lesbian. Troublemaking cunt, split tail up in the front office. I think God's got a sense of humor. Now, I want you to know something. At this point in my life, after I had dealt with that thing in San Diego, when I went to the university to go to work, I want you to know what I did. I put a picture of me sitting on one of my best friend's lap, a male friend, and I told everybody that Jeff was my fiance. And I lied. You know what? I'm not proud that I did that. But I did that because, you know what? I just didn't think I could take any more shit. And you know what? They ended up calling me a wasted piece of ass anyhow. It's like you totally abandon yourself. And you do, you know, it's that whole thing. Just tell me who you want me to be so you'll accept me and I'll do that. And I did that. In sobriety, I did that. And you know, one day I walked out of the building. There he was with that other guy. There goes our wasted piece of ass. I want you to know, though, I never, ever spoke to them. I never once said anything to them. But I did walk across the parking lot and I broke down. And I started to cry and I went home. You know, right now I'm coming up on 7 years sober. And what do you do? What do you do with that? You talk to your sponsor about it. You know, somebody I sponsored called me up on the telephone. Said, "Edie, I want to spit on somebody." I said, "I know, I had that same thought today." But I know that when I'm in a place like that, the best thing for me to do is read from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I picked up that book and I opened it up, and it's wonderful where God, you know, how God works in our lives. And right there it said, it was right before it gets to the promises, and it says that we're a doormat to no one, that we're children of God. And it goes into the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found myself, you wouldn't believe, like as if I were an Amway presentator. I was just preaching. Oh, well, you just gotta turn it over to God and the promises. And I hurt myself. I thought to myself, well, why don't you try to buy some of this stuff you're pushing over here on her? You know how quickly, you know. It was the truth. I want you to know that I went back the next day and I filed a grievance against that place. It was probably the hardest thing I ever went through because it was sexual harassment having to do with orientation. Sexual orientation. I want you to know that they pulled my DMV records and they pulled everything they could to try to find something wrong with me. It was the hardest thing I ever walked through. And I walked through it, and I want you to know I didn't drink. And when they took me into the labor relations with the big shot in labor relations, you know what he said to me? He looked down at me and he said, "You know, Edie, if this goes all the way to trial, there's a lot of things that'll have to come out." Yeah, there's a lot of things that are going to have to come out. And I'm thinking, that's interesting. And he said, we see that in your medical records you've had problems with drugs and alcohol. And I thought, you sleazy son of a gun. And he says, "You know, all that'll have to come out." And I said, "Well, whose attorney would you like to have share that? Mine or yours? Because I'd like to have members of Alcoholics Anonymous in the room to let you know that I've done meetings in San Quentin and that by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a sober, contributing member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And he's, "Oh, no. Oh, no." You know, I'm about out of time, and those people with the walkie-talkies are probably getting all antsy. I want you to know that you got something to give us. And that don't ever sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and think that you have nothing to share. Because there's nobody else like you. So I invite you to please step into sharing with us who you are. I'm going to tell you a couple little stories and then I'll sit down. Lately, in the last couple of years, I've really gotten in touch with my background, my Indian background. I'm a California Costanoan Indian. I'm sure you've never heard of us. I'd love to be a Cherokee, or since Dan Favreau is the whole world's Cherokee or Apache, but I'm a Costanoan. And I'm proud of it. And in October, the first weekend of October, in Las Vegas, they have a big Indian conference, and I invite you all to go. It's an incredible experience, and they do it the Indian way. I was instead of marathon meetings, they have talking circles, and you have to stay until everybody's completely done sharing. And there was a medicine man who's 93 years old, 15 years sober. Don't know why, but he was. I was impressed. And he told a really wonderful story about when he was a little boy growing up on the reservation. And every time he turned around, the wise man, always the medicine man of the reservation, had a rock. And he always wondered what that old man was doing with those rocks. Like, were they special rocks, or what were those rocks? And when he got to the age where he was the height of the medicine man's shoulder, he could then speak to him. So he went to the old medicine man, and he says, "Old medicine man, what are those rocks? Are those spiritual rocks, or those rocks have special powers?" And he said, "Well, no, son." He put his hand on his shoulder, and he says, "I'm just moving that mountain, one rock at a time." And he said that as Indians and people in recovery, that we look at our lives as a huge mountain that we'll never be able to move, that we'll never be able to overcome. And he told that story that what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, is that we were powerless over alcohol, and that we get to help each other carry each other's rocks. He also closed that meeting with sharing a story about how it's important to go to all these faraway places. And as young people, we choose to go to a lot of faraway places. And we want to go to Hawaii and all these wonderful places. And that when we're there, what we should do is we should pick up the soil, and we should pick up the leaves, and we should feel Mother Earth and get in touch. He says, "When you come home, know where you live. Know where you live." And he says, "But I want you to know that the longest journey you'll ever take will be from your mind to your heart. And I want you to know that tonight, it's been a privilege to share with you, because I've made that journey from my mind to my heart. And thank you for the generous listening that you've provided me. And if you're new, please come back. Thank you."